let me get started with a few preliminary comments, and then we can sort of go from there. My name is John Jensen. I teach at Luther College, and I'm thrilled that you're all here. At 4 o'clock, I'm usually sort of dozing off, and maybe it's because I'm a morning person, and so I appreciate your taking part of your afternoon to come here and be part of this session from there. So that, as you all know, the teaching staff coordinators have the job of bringing in lots of experts, and they do that, experts in theology and other areas, and then they also bring in people like me. I feel like if there's one thing I'm not, it's an expert. My background is in philosophy, and philosophers, I think, oftentimes dabble in lots of different things. And so if I have expertise in anything at all, and I do a lot of work in environmental issues, but I think the expertise of philosophers is in asking questions. So I am not going to lecture at you for the most part, and what I want to try to do is engage you in part of the process that's involved in what I think of as doing ethics. What I'm going to try to do with other sessions throughout the week is look at some particular issues, from endangered species to wilderness to mining to looking at broader issues of sustainability. But what I want to do today is do a little bit of work, or actually get you to do a little bit of work in thinking about the process of doing ethics. And not just thinking about it, but actually engaging in doing it. When I was in graduate school, one of my professors used to say that he thought philosophy, and in particular ethics, was the closest to gym class of anything else. It should be an activity where you're doing things. And that's sort of my philosophy resulting of it as well. So what I want to try to do today is hopefully give you a little bit of a taste of what's involved in the process of doing some environmental ethics, which is involved in questions, but also in looking at case studies. And so what I want to do, and maybe this will be enjoyable and maybe not, I'll let you decide as we go through it, is I've got a series of 6 case studies that I'd like you to think and talk through that hopefully gets us into asking some of the broader questions that environmental ethics ultimately engages us in. And in order to do that, I want you to be able to do something with me, which is to have an ethics buddy, what I would call them for today. We're far too big of a group to be able to actually all of us engage in this process. So I would like you to have a partner with, I'm going to ask you to talk through each one of these cases. I'll give you about 4 minutes with each of the cases, so we won't have a lot of time to go into a tremendous amount of depth, but in each one of the cases, I actually want you to talk through what would you do in this scenario and why. Philosopher's favorite question is always why. What is it that's behind that decision? But part of what I want you to do is just your gut reaction, your intuition. If I was in that situation, what would I do in that situation? And in each case, I want to try to bring some of that out, but I also want to tease out what are the bigger issues or what are the bigger questions that come out of that. And we'll try to build up some of the terminology that's there that might help us a little bit in thinking through some of these cases, but also, hopefully, it's provocative in and of itself in thinking about some of these different cases. Some of them are environmental and some of them aren't, but it's ultimately that bigger process that's involved. Before we get into that, I just want to sort of indicate, for me, ultimately it's about what are the questions that we're looking at. And I'm not going to do very much with the computer. We'll do a little bit at the beginning, a little bit at the end, but then try to do this as interactively as possible. But ultimately, the questions I think we're after is, how do we decide the right thing to do when faced with difficult decisions? Ethics is not, at least in my perspective, someone telling you this is the right thing to do. It's about that process. How is it that you decide what it is that you should do in a given case? How do you determine what that is? What are the sources of your moral norms? How is it, what are you ultimately appealing to? Is that a religious basis or a secular one? Do you go to scripture? Do you go to prayer? Ultimately, is it something that you sort of try to reason through in your own mind from there? The question of environmental ethics is very much a question about the moral community. And we'll talk a little bit more about what that means and the notion of sort of expanding the moral community. A few more. What is the role of humans on Earth? How do we understand how we fit into the broader sweep of creation? One of the wonderful things about Holden Village is I think it sort of prompts the question of where do I fit in? We're tucked in this little valley. There's the amazing sort of beauty and also the majesty, but also the kind of power of nature that is around us. How do we fit into that? How do we understand our role? And looking at the mine remediation, I think raises lots of these questions. How do I understand where we fit in? What's the best way to resolve differences over conflicting values and perspectives? Ultimately, we need a process if we're going to sort through this. It's one of the biggest things that's happened in the last 20 years as environmental issues have become incredibly political. They're very sort of politically charged in a way that they weren't. If you go back into the 1970s, environmental issues were some of the bipartisan issues that were there. But things sort of shifted through the 80s in our culture, and ultimately we need a way of resolving those. Finally, how do we resolve conflicts between human interests and environmental concerns? We'll talk a little bit more of that, and how do we balance the interests of those living now with future generations? But what I'm interested in then is to sort of dive into some cases. So here's what I'd like you to do. I would like you to find one other person, we can have some groups of three if you will, that you can engage with the process of talking through some of these individual case studies. I'm not in a position of sort of enforcing how you do that, but my preference would be that it's not somebody that you know really well. I think oftentimes it's better if it's not someone who is already your spouse or best friend or someone that you interact with regularly, but somebody who brings fresh eyes, who doesn't necessarily know how you think about it. So I would encourage you, if you need to move around, introduce yourself to someone, find yourself a partner, and then we'll go from there. I'll tell you the case in just a minute. All right, can I have your attention? Does everybody have an ethics buddy or a group that you're ready? So we will not have, I am not going to give you a lot of time. I want to get through a bunch of different ones. I sort of just want to spark your thinking. So I do want you, when the time comes, to not let one person dominate the conversation with their long, drawn-out explanation, but sort of quickly talk through, here's what I would do, and then the other person have some chance to sort of talk about it. Here's your first case. Maybe it's an easy one, maybe not, from there. You're walking down the street. You're on the way to your church. You're going to a fundraiser for Lutheran World Relief. And you know that what's going to happen there is they're raising money for famine relief, which you think of as something, an issue that you've studied and you know is an incredibly important issue. On your way, you happen to look down and on the side you find a wallet. You reach down, you pick it up. As you would always do, you search for identification. Certainly there must be some sort of ID, a business card, a driver's license, something. Nothing there whatsoever that gives anyone's name. What is in that wallet are two things. A big, thick stack of $100 bills. So who carries $100 bills in our society? Nobody that I know.
Yeah, the drug runners.
Drug runners. And actually, as you look through it a little further, you find some information that indicates two things. Number one, the person is a member of the very exclusive country club that you know is only the super rich. And you get some indication that this person, because of what you can see in there, might be involved with a business that you know has recently been written up for unethical practices related to bankruptcy. So what do you know? You know that this person almost certainly doesn't need the money and probably won't do anything good with it. Should you take the money out of the wallet, take it and donate it to Lutheran World Relief to do good work for famine relief? Or turn it into the police where hopefully they can find it and return it to the wealthy person who doesn't need it anyway. 4 minutes, what would you do in this case? The case of the lost wallet. What would you do in thinking through it? With your partner, what would you do and why? How do you think through this question?
There's a third option there.
There may be other options. I want to know what you would do. You can think about creative options.
Certainly.
me have your attention back here if I could. We won't have time to talk through all of them in depth. I'm more interested in you working through it, but let's hear from a couple of groups that what your solution. What would you do in this case? Somebody who wants to weigh in. Yes?
I'd be so tempted to Robin Hood it. I would really be tempted.
Yeah. To steal from the rich to give to the poor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes? Yes?
I wouldn't feel right doing that until I had tried to find who it belonged to. But the problem is, of course, they have to identify it.
Mm-hmm.
And with no identification, they're going to have to be able to describe it and tell what's in it. And if the money has come from a illegal source, then they're not able to do that. But if you've tried that, then I would feel comfortable doing something good with the money.
But your sense of the right thing to do is to return the wallet to its rightful owner. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, if that's possible.
Mm-hmm. We just turn it into the authorities and not leave our name.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because it's not ours.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we don't necessarily want them to know who we are. It might be some problems with us, so it's better just to give it and put it there.
We don't want to turn it in to get a reward. We just want to turn it in because that's the right thing to do.
Because that's the right thing to do. The right thing to do is to return it again, right? You're saying no. Why not?
I think for me, it's more complex than that. The only other thought I had was if I could have a shot at talking to that person whose money it was and changing their heart,
we think we're going to change their heart because we've turned it all in.
Ah, I see. So you ultimately think it's going
to
come back around.
We don't even have to say anything. Uh-huh. That they're going to be impressed.
Uh-huh. We're going to move on in just a minute, but yes?
We're also going to give it to the police, but we're going to tell the police if they can't find the owner, we want the money to go to them.
Good show.
but the sense is, let me make sure I understand here. On the one hand, we say there is some sort of either spoken or unspoken rule in our society that this property belongs to someone else and that it should be returned to its rightful owner. There's a sort of moral responsibility to follow such a rule. On the same hand, at least some of you believe that no. Given the scenario as it is hypothetically set up, there would be a better outcome if you take this action versus that action, ultimately. And so ultimately, what I'm interested in us thinking about ethics is that are we interested in ethics as a matter of following rules? Here's an understanding of what's the right thing to do. Or ultimately, is it a matter of trying to achieve what is the best outcome? And what I'd like to do is move on to the second case to talk just a little bit more about it. Philosophers sometimes are fond of what are called trolley problems. I'd like to do a Holden Village version of a trolley problem, which are hypothetical cases and try to get us at something.
I have a little twist to this. Let's say that it's your wallet that was lost.
Yep.
You're not a member of this exclusive group, but it was money for some other good purpose, and you lost the wallet. Would you want someone to return it to you? The golden rule.
Pardon me?
The golden rule.
So another rule. So is ethics a matter of rules? Or is ethics a matter of coming up with the best outcome? Let's come on to the next case and we'll come back to it from there, if you will. You have been taken on a stint as a worker at Holden Village. You've gotten trained in and you are one of the bus drivers. You are headed down the mountain with a busload of people. It so happens that everybody in this room is on the bus with you. Probably some friends of yours, some people that you know well as you're heading down there. It's one of your first trips down the mountain in the bus, so you kind of forget about that important thing about stopping to check your brakes before you head down the switchbacks from there. As you head towards the first switchback, you push down on that brake pedal. It's soft. There's nothing there in front of you as you push down on that brake pedal. You realize that your brakes are gone, and you're headed towards the switchbacks with a busload of 30 people, more or less, along the way. You don't know exactly what's going to happen, but you have a pretty good idea that if you're not able to slow that bus down, that you will head off the edge of that switchback. And based on what you've been told in your training before, there's a very high likelihood that everyone on the bus, including yourself, will die. Just at that point, the radio crackles, and you hear that there is one of the mine remediation workers that is parked with their pickup at a turnout spot just before you get to the end of the switchback. You know, because you studied physics in high school, that given the velocity of your bus as you are moving down there, if you can hit that pickup at the right angle, at the right speed, you will stop your bus before it goes off the edge. You're also pretty sure that the angle that you have to hit it is likely to kill the person as the mine worker who is sitting inside that pickup at that time. You will be choosing to take the life of an innocent person by your action to steer the bus into that. But if you do nothing, the likely outcome is that you kill the 30 people that are on the bus along with yourself at that point. What would you do in that situation and why?
Those are the only two choices.
Well, that's the scenario. If you have another option, you can sort of bring it out. But that's the scenario as it comes to you. You've got a couple of minutes with your ethics buddy to talk it through, and then we'll sort of bring it back out. One or two responses, and then we'll keep ourselves moving along. Anybody want to jump in? What would you do? Yeah.
There's option three, and that's just go into the ditch and scrape the bus to a stop.
Yeah, everybody, yeah. Same thing.
Everybody gets shook around, but probably no one gets killed.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So, I mean, let me just sort of, part of what I want to do is frame things up for us as well. We often talk about moral dilemmas. And the idea of a moral dilemma is that you have two bad choices and you're not sure what to do with it. And oftentimes we talk about the horns of a dilemma. And I've always sort of thought about it in terms of the, if you think about Texas Longhorn cattle with those big old horns out there. I worked for a little while at a place in Kansas where we had a herd of Texas Longhorns. And when we'd go in to move them, sometimes they would just be shaking their heads all around and they were after each other. But the idea is, all right, do I want to get gored by the left horn or the right horn? They're bad options from there. But one of the ways that we approach moral dilemmas is we try to look for a third way. We try to split the horns. Is there a way that I can do this? And obviously, I try to set things up in such a way that you only have that dilemma. Yeah. Yeah. But if we have a way out of it, that's what we always want to do. Creative thinking is a huge part of any sort of problem solving, but the same is true in ethical situations as well. So that's great from there.
Well, I mean, our group is pretty unanimous that we would try any third option that is available, but if that ain't the case, the guy in the truck dies.
Okay, why?
One for 30.
Okay.
One for 31. That's just...
It's a numbers thing. When it comes down to it, you just have to, if everything else fails, ultimately the right thing to do is the thing that results in the least number of deaths from there.
Mm-hmm. We also decided, though, to be beeping the horn, trying to get this bank, like you're talking about, but having the people going out the back, bailing out of the bus.
Good.
Roll the bus on its side.
Good. I want you all as my bus drivers. That's good.
Why would the driver of the truck stay in his truck if he knew that this was...
Well, he may or may not, but obviously another third option is to try to radio and say, leave your truck there, but get out as quickly as you can. The reality, though, is we do at times face moral dilemmas. And we should try everything we can to get out of them, but at times we are faced with those sorts of dilemmas that are there. And ultimately, what I'm interested in is the broader point that ethics, one of the fundamental divides, and it's not an either-or, but there are two dimensions of making ethical decisions. Part of that is following rules. I should always tell the truth. Unless telling a lie ultimately results in something that seems like a much better outcome from there. And how do I sort of weigh that out? And there certainly are people in the history of philosophy, as well as on sort of the side of Christian ethics, that weigh very strongly that it's always a matter of weighing the consequences, or it's always a matter of following the rules from there. Immanuel Kant famously said, even if there's a murderer at the door asking you if the person that they're after is there, you should still tell the truth. He sort of sat very staunchly on there. And in the philosophical tradition, ultimately outcomes comes down on the side of utilitarianism. That ultimately the right thing to do is the thing that results in the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And regardless of the fact that that violates rules along the way. So it is a divide that's there, but it's a divide that's there within the Christian tradition as well. Is ethics ultimately about following the Ten Commandments? Thou shalt not. We should do this, or we should do that, or it's the golden rule. Or is Christian ethics ultimately about working for the kingdom of God on earth? That's not a matter of some rules. That's saying this is the outcome that we're looking for, and ultimately what we should do is try to achieve justice in the world. Or we should do something on that side. There's this tension between the two from there. Is ethics ultimately about saying you always return the property? Property? Is property a biblical concept? To some extent it is, although there's a whole different economic system that's at work there. And our notions of property as sort of ultimate ethical considerations are much more capitalistic than they are Christian, I would suggest to you. And this notion that what I should do is do good in the world. You know, St. Thomas Aquinas said that all that we have in excess is owed by necessity to the poor. There's an ethical sort of guideline that says what we're called to do is to achieve the best outcome with the work that we do. This plays very prominently into environmental ethics in ways that will come on from there. I want to talk about the Holden mine a little bit. I mean, it's the same sort of thing. Part of what is at work in thinking about the Holden mine is this very prominent principle. Ethical principle in our lives. If we make a mess, you clean it up. I say to my daughter, Lily, you made that mess, you clean it up. But do we do that? And there, that gets sort of, that gets quantified in the sense of this principle of the polluter pays. The Holden mine is an absolutely fascinating case because the company that is responsible for it is saying, yes, we'll pay for it. Rio Tinto is saying, we'll pay for it. And people are saying, the polluter pays. Is that what we want? Or do we want to say, is a cost-benefit analysis of the Holden mine cleanup say that ultimately this results in more harm than good? I had a 30-minute conversation on the trail this morning with a person who will be the superintendent of the quarry. He said they're going to take 100,000 yards of riprap out of that quarry out by 10 Mile Falls out there. It will be a totally different valley after they do the mine remediation than it was before from there. When I've had my students study this case in depth, probably 80% of them said, we think the mine remediation, based on what we know, will do more harm than good. And that's not counting on the $150 million price tag and asking, what could you do with $150 million from there? But what I want to say is ultimately this gets at this sort of fundamental issue. Is it about the rule, polluter pays, or is it about the cost-benefit analysis? What are the harms versus the benefits that sort of work out from there? That's one piece of ethics. I want to keep us sort of moving through, and we'll have time for some questions at the end as well. Can I give you another case? A little one that maybe is easier, maybe harder, I don't know. Your congregation was given by a member who passed away recently a 10-acre parcel of land on the outskirts of town. That 10-acre parcel of land is adjoining to some parkland that's there, and that property is very much desired by the local park system as something that they see as valuable. You have members of your congregation that say very strongly, we need to take this and give it that it can be there for wildlife habitat, can be there as a green space in our community. There are also, maybe you don't have vocal people in your congregation, but there are also vocal people saying, no, no, what we need to do is we need to sell that land. And in fact, because it's very desirable, a developer has come forward and said, I'll give you $2 million for that because I want to put up a set of condos on that property. And there are people who are saying, no, no, we need to be good stewards of this gift that was given to our congregation. And even among the folks that want to sell it, there's a divide. Some people say, let's put this into an endowment to help us meet our church expenses. We've struggled through tithes to meet our expenses. This would help us significantly. Others on the mission committee are saying, no, we should take that money and give it away. What would you do in this situation? What would you say as part of the congregation? But I want to take this a step further because ultimately I'm interested in something else. How would you decide? How would you go about deciding what your view is on this? Would it be something that you would talk with your spouse or close friends about? Would you pray about it? Would you go to Scripture and sort of try to see what would be the direction that's there? Would you make a list of pros and cons of what you think of the different options from there? I want to give you a case. I want you to sort of think about, what is my process for making a hard decision? Where do I look for guidance along the way? So it's not just what would you do, but how would you approach a tough question? Where do you look for ethical guidance about what the right thing to do is? So again, talk it through with your ethics buddy, but focus a little bit on that process. How would you think about this? How would you sort of work through it along the way? Let's bring it back together again if we could from there. I want to get at the stuff that's behind it, but let's talk about the case for just a couple of minutes from there. Yes?
We think that the church should be working to find an environmentally conscious builder.
Ah, okay.
Who will make sure that if they do build, that it'll be green buildings, and they will have lots of hidden, so that the buildings will be hidden. Mm-hmm. So then both you save the view as well and the space as well as money for the church.
Mm-hmm. Trying to split the horns of the dilemma again from there. Yeah.
I just want to say there's a congregation that had this very dilemma who had a unique solution. St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Manhattan. They're about 72nd in Lexington on the east side of the park. They had a very valuable parcel of land and a church that was struggling. And I think it was a bank, a huge bank, Bancorp or somebody, Citicorp, offered them millions for the land.
Mm-hmm.
They decided that their church would die. And they got a deal with the bank where they let the bank build on their property a small skyscraper in exchange for a lot of money to excavate below it and put their congregation underground. They have a jazz in New York, St. Peter's Lutheran Church, ESVA
uh-huh.
Church.
Uh-huh.
They have a jazz service underground, and they serve the homeless a buffet dinner with the money they got.
Uh-huh. That's great. I mean, it's a good, again, it's sort of creative thinking about how you do it from there.
So something like this, there never is just one or two solutions. There are many. Like, for example, in Orcas Island up in the San Juans, there was this huge estate that went up for sale, and a private developer was going to buy it out, but they organized enough people and got some foundations and went out to put money in to buy it as a park. That's the way it ended up. So it's Turtleback Mountain on Orcas Island.
That's great. Yes?
Well, I think the most important part of your question was how would you decide?
Yes.
Because I know at least a part of how I would decide is I would listen to others in the community.
Mm-hmm.
I would really listen to the sense of the community. And that would be dishonest if you already knew how you were going to decide.
Uh-huh.
That listening would not have integrity then.
Uh-huh.
So either with listening or praying, I hope I would pray about it. I think there needs to be some openness to go.
Mm-hmm.
In a variety of directions for that to be an honest method.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And ultimately, I mean, part of the reason we're even doing this is I want to convey the idea that ethics is ultimately a communal process. It's something that's based on dialogue and exchange, etc. from there. But I do think it's an interesting question for Christians of to what extent is prayer or going to scripture or going to tradition sort of an essential piece of that, because part of what you get by asking the congregation is you get the kind of common denominator of a group of people at a particular time and place, which may or may not be consistent with the broader sort of tradition and what comes out of that from there. Yeah.
How you view the overall decision. Do you view yourself as being an owner / consumer of the end product, or as a steward of it? You want it to, you know, human beings are going to die. The land is going to be there for you. I'm curious, at least, certainly not the only, I think, influencing your decision, but at least that may that's a starting point.
Mm-hmm. Well, that seems like a vote in favor of sort of putting the land above, say, the poor. Human beings are going to die, so therefore that's something we shouldn't pay as much attention to as preserving the land forever. Is that right?
No.
Okay. So then why not take the money and give it to the poor? We know that there are a billion people in the world that are food insecure. So people...
That same argument for, say 1,000 acres of forest.
Mm-hmm.
You go in there and you can clear cut, and you get a nice pile.
Yep.
And it rains and it washes away the dirt, and all of a sudden you've got a pile of rocks that nothing's ever going to grow on.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can harvest the land, harvest the trees sensibly, and basically forever.
Mm-hmm.
And there are forests, we all know there are examples of that all over the world.
Yep. But I do think it comes down to hard choices at times. And many people are wanting to say that ultimately people are the priority. And when we have to make hard choices, we should favor people first. And that, I would say, is a particularly Christian perspective that comes out at different times. And I think this sort of tension is part of what I'm interested in you guys struggling with.
Not the people that exist right now. What about the next generation?
Good question. What about the next generation?
If you stewardship for it now, it'll be some good to be drawn from it in future generations.
Sure. Mostly from the wealthy in the wealthy global north. Meanwhile, people in other places are suffering. Are we comfortable with those trade-offs?
You're not going to be able to feed everybody from the results of that specific sale.
Absolutely. But you might feed some.
I think there's two issues.
Our congregation has, in fact, dealt with this issue recently. Mm-hmm. We were given a piece of land adjoining our property as a total gift by the deceased. And I was like, wow, we got money now that we can whatever. Mm-hmm. And I brought it to council. And council had the conversation, said, we've got to go back to the family that donated it to us. And so they decided, the family was honoring their parents by giving the land to the church. Mm-hmm. And so our decision was not to sell it to the person who wanted to buy it at a nice sum, because we need to honor those people. Now also, into your scenario, there is a value for virgin property that once it's developed, it's gone for generations forever. And so to make that into a park, to give it to the park service for future generations, would be probably the northern Minnesota choice.
Part of what I want to get across to you, and one of the take-home... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just think there's two things there. First of all, it's like, there's this kind of concept of ethical stewardship, mm-hmm. and I just challenged people to think, are the fish stewards of the ocean? Are we really stewards of the earth, number one? And second thing is what you said about it becoming, ethics being kind of the common denominator. And that worries me, because common denominator is only a step away from the lowest common denominator. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where we tend to go. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's worrisome to me. So that's kind of where I base my decision. Mm-hmm. The common wisdom is not very wise.
Sometimes. But let's think about it. I want to say a little bit more about the sort of process and then move on. But I do want to say that part of the take home that I hope you get is that there are almost never any easy answers. And the people that sort of want to say to you, it's black and white, it's obvious, this is exactly the right thing to do, part of our role may be to ask the hard questions that sort of come back to it again. I think appreciating complexity and understanding the real trade-offs that are often involved in many of our decisions that for the most part we don't tend to see is part of the process that's involved from there. I did ask you to think about the process, and I do want you to think just a little bit more. Part of what I do want you to think about is this possible trade-off between things related to the environment versus humans from there. And I think those trade-offs are real, and we'll talk more about it. But I'm more interested at this point in thinking about ethics, about the difference between religious or secular approaches. And ultimately, where are the sources of your moral norms? Is all of ethics ultimately about looking to God? And if so, how do we understand that we access what those norms look like from there? So if we're saying that on the religious side, ultimately all of ethics comes back to God, that still leaves lots of questions. Is that ultimately through Scripture? Is this where we turn for our moral guidance, is to look to it from there? Is it something that comes more directly through prayer? Or perhaps through turning to people within the church, and whether that is clergy, whether that's sort of within the tradition, etc., that's there, that can be sort of leaders, but it also can be the congregation along the way. But the question ultimately that comes back, and I think that you're raising very nicely, is to say, when we get to this point, are we ultimately still on a religious trajectory, or is what we tend to get coming out of that just whatever is the cultural norm of the time? And if so, what do we as Christians do in trying to access what's there? Do we see the sort of piece of that in terms of where it comes out? And ultimately, even again, I would suggest within Scripture, within the religious tradition, we're still at tension between rules and outcome from there. Ultimately, I mean, what Christian ethicists talk about is the divine command theory, to essentially say what is right is what comes as God's word from there. How do we access that? But ultimately, that is sort of tends to be on the side more of the deontological or the sort of rules-based side of that. On the secular side of it, again, how do we understand what's there? Does it ultimately come down to weighing out the consequences? Are we looking to reason, or are we looking ultimately kind of to culture, to tradition? How do we understand, how do we weigh out the different pieces of it are there? I think most of us make decisions. Well, first of all, most of us do most everything as a habit. I mean, studies show that roughly half of all the decisions that we make on a daily basis are purely habit, are not thought through at all. Many of those are very ethically sort of rich decisions, whether we think about it or not. And I want to move into a food case here in just a minute. But as we begin to think about where we're going, how do we make decisions? Where do we look to for the sources of our moral norms along the way? Does it come from society? Does it come from the church? Does it come from Scripture? Does it come from hopefully some sort of combination of different things from there? And I think as Paul is suggesting, oftentimes these are community decisions and trying to understand, but even with thinking to community, how do you as a clergy person guide your congregation in thinking through these difficult processes from there? You know, in the case that we're talking about, maybe it's easy. Maybe there's direction that comes from the donor, but oftentimes donors don't give direction. Oftentimes it's in the will without something that's direct there. I want to move on and make sure we get to a couple of more cases as we think about it from there. And so I'd like to do one that is food related here, back in the context of Holden Village, if we could. Here's the scenario. You're a member of the Holden Village Board of Directors, and a fellow director has proposed a policy that Holden Village become a purely vegetarian site, serving no meat whatsoever. This board member has just completed a presentation on the gruesome methods of animal agriculture and made a passionate plea that all God's creatures, not just human beings, deserve our respect and protection. Furthermore, she argued persuasively that the environmental impacts of animal agriculture are devastating and that Holden Village needs to take a stand for our non-human allies and be a leader in further demonstrating creation care. In response, a longtime board member rose to say that God made humans in his own image, that we are set apart from the rest of creation, and thus that it's fine for us to eat the animals. After all, it says in Genesis that God put all of nature here for our benefit. Now you have been asked to speak on this resolution. What would you say, and how would you vote? Back to your ethics, buddy. Question of making Holden Village all vegetarian.
Thank you.
seems like a pretty good
Let me have your attention again. Again, just 2 minutes on the case, and then let's sort of tease out a little bit of what's behind it from there. Again, somebody who hasn't been in our conversation want to weigh in on what came out from your discussion?
Yeah. I think we decided we would not say anything. Just watch what happened.
That might be very wise. Yes?
I've kind of tossed around this end because there was a young lady that wrote a book about vegetarianism and for kids, and she put some pretty good things in there as far as I was concerned. But to me, personally, plants are a living thing also. Mm-hmm. So the ethical problem of animals versus plants, wait a minute, you'll kill plants to eat, but you won't kill animals. But they're all living things to me, so, mm-hmm. But we do have to eat. Mm-hmm. So that's where I stand.
Good, and I do want to get at some of the ethical perspectives that are behind there, but let me just try to respond to that quickly because I think it helps us sort of tease some things out of it from there. If I take this marker and slam it down on the floor, you might say, this guy's crazy, but you wouldn't think that I am unethical. If I took my daughter and slammed her down on the floor, you would think, oh my God, we got to do something about this right away. This guy is really a lunatic. If I took a corn plant and slammed it down on the floor, also a living thing, you wouldn't think anything about it. What's the difference?
I don't know. Maybe I would. Is it a living corn plant? Why would you do that?
It's a good question. Why would I do it from there? For folks that are really interested in this ethical perspective, the dividing line is the ability to feel pain. So there is actually, for most folks who are really sort of pushing an animal welfare ethical perspective, it's the ability to feel pain. They don't care if you slap mosquitoes.
But science again has a discussion. I mean, there is plants that feel pain or feel. I mean, if you take a Venus biplant trap and you touch it, it closes up or whatever. So they're feeling. So I mean, we haven't discovered all of that.
Yeah, maybe.
We cannot understand the communication that a plant has because we aren't a corn plant.
Right.
Or stem or grass or whatever. But we have more kinship to our own brethren than we would to, say, a deer or a cow, or
in other words, it's ethical because we don't understand the mechanism of the plant, but we understand the mechanism, so it's more ethical to keep them alive than as a plant.
Yeah, certainly lots of people have argued that we don't understand enough about animals to understand that they're pain. I don't think that's a very common perspective these days anymore in terms of it from there. But clearly all living things, there is a kinship that's there along the way from there. And ultimately we'll get a couple more in. Go ahead.
Me?
Okay. Yes.
Well, there should be a decision people can agree on. Marva Dawn pointed out in the church she was in, everything was decided by consensus. You know, a 51-49 vote means that you really are polarizing the church. You're not solving a problem. Mm-hmm. Stay with the problem, figure out what both sides can live with, and work towards that solution.
Mm-hmm. So working for a compromise in between, yeah.
We thought about a compromise and perhaps just do 2 days a week with meat and vegetarian for the rest. Mm-hmm.
Well, so you might, yeah.
And we also talked about how important we thought it would be to lift up that the way animals are being described by that one perspective is not the way all animals are raised and treated.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is probably the way that the vast majority of them are being raised and treated.
But many of us go to farmers markets and buy meat from.
We can choose who we buy from.
There you're into another sort of third way perspective.
Yeah.
Here's the bigger point that I want to make sort of in thinking about this. We do tend to think in terms of there being individuals that are part of the moral community. Part of the reason that I can slam my marker down is because I suspect nobody here thinks that an Expo dry erase marker is part of the moral community. But part of the reason I can't do it to my daughter is because she is clearly a part of the moral community. Yes, it's legal, but I'm interested in the sort of piece of that from there. As lots of writers have shown, we have, through the history of humanity, expanded who's included in the moral community. Clearly within our own country. We don't have to go back very far at all to understand that people with skin colors different than ours, than everyone in this room, were not seen as part of the moral community. In many cases, women have not been seen as part of the moral community. Part of the history of human civilization has been an expansion of the moral community to take in more people. We certainly don't act that way in many of our policies, but we tend to at least say that we agree that all human beings are now part of the moral community. But understanding sort of some of the questions that people interested in environmental ethics are asked is saying, is it time to ask questions about expanding the moral community again, to include certain animals? I would argue that, in fact, we do include some animals effectively within our moral community. If I said to you that we're not going to keep serving beef at Holden Village, but we're going to start serving dog on a regular basis, there would be an outcry. But in certain parts of the world, dogs are seen as much more acceptable to eat than others. This is largely a sort of cultural construction of what's there. And I think a lot of people in the animal rights community are arguing that if we look forward 100 years, people are going to look back and say, is it really the case that people used to think that animals didn't sort of fit into that sort of moral community in quite the same way? I think one of the questions that environmental ethics sort of pushes us to ask is to say, are we being short-sighted in how we define our own moral community now? Do we tend to sort of see it primarily on a local basis? How is it that I live in tremendous luxury compared to the vast majority of people in the world, and I think that's okay, as opposed to thinking that I may have greater responsibilities? How is it that I think it's okay that animals are, many of whom have sort of tremendously similar abilities and capabilities as human beings do, are treated in entirely different ways as we think about things from there?
But isn't the issue, at least the issue for me, is more how many resources or what kind of resources it takes to produce 1 pound of animal to eat as opposed to 1 pound of vegetables mm-hmm. or corn to eat. More my question.
There are very powerful arguments for either a vegetarian diet or one that dramatically limits our meat consumption on purely human grounds. Whether we're interested in water or soil or energy from there. I mean, there's another sort of set of arguments there that really don't get into the issues of animals, et cetera, from there. And there's lots of people that are interested in saying that ultimately that expansion of the moral community cannot stop with animals. I mean, Aldo Leopold in a Sand County Almanac and his essay, The Land Ethic, ultimately argues that what we need to do is expand our notion of the moral community that include soils, water, plants, animals, and collectively what he called the land. The notion of the land ethic is ultimately understood as an expansion of the moral community beyond simply animals to the land. Now, ultimately, Leopold was a hunter. And he believed that you could include animals within the moral community and still consume them. It's a very different relationship than we tend to have with animals, where we lock them up in closed buildings, treat them in absolutely incredible ways, and are sort of totally separated from it.
Well, and somehow that moral community, when I think about the ethics of that, I mean, we send our sons and daughters to Afghanistan to be slaughtered for some ideology. What's wrong with slaughtering animals for food, for sustenance? So it's like, okay, if we're all part of the same moral community, where does ethics come down? Okay, what's okay to kill, or when is it okay to kill something for the greater good?
Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, this gets us at the final distinction that I want us to make. I mean, the one that's here that I think is really important is that there is a fundamental difference between something that is focused on humans, what people tend to call an anthropocentric, a human-centered, or a non-anthropocentric perspective. Ultimately, are we interested in a perspective that puts humans at the center, which is the way that we tend to think of ethics primarily, or are we interested in something that tries to move beyond the anthropocentric perspective to understand things from the perspective of other animals or plants? Or in Leopold's case, much more broadly than that. And then finally, the distinction that's crucial here is between a perspective that focuses on individuals or one that is more holistic. That when I'm making the case about vegetarianism, ultimately folks interested in that animal welfare perspective are interested in taking the current ethical framework that says every individual human being is deserving of respect, is deserving of rights, and saying, but how can we draw that line between Homo sapiens and others and say, shouldn't other living beings that meet some set of criteria also have human rights? But there's a whole other set of perspectives that say, no, the problem is more with the individualistic focus. Why do we think that I, as an individual, am so deserving of human rights? Don't we need something that looks more broadly at a holistic perspective? So Leopold says, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It's wrong when it tends otherwise. The ultimate ethical standard is the whole biotic community. It's the whole ecosystem. It's the larger creation. And that the problem comes with an excessive focus on individuals, on the individual as the most important, as the kind of central entity that we look at from there. And what I'd like to do, I want to be sensitive to the time and that food is coming up. Hopefully with some of these perspectives, this helps us to understand some of what's out there. I want to give you, in very simplistic form, four different perspectives on environmental ethics that relate to some of the stuff that's up there as a way of trying to think through some of the stuff that we come across along the way. And ultimately, what I'm interested in is taking some of, hopefully, the thought processes that have come out of here today and being able to apply them to individual cases as we go through. So I'll come back to this in just a minute. But you all may... here are four different perspectives. Not that there are only four. There are an infinite number. But trying to get at different ways of understanding our role. Humanism, not what we oftentimes think of as humanism, but ultimately compatible with it, I would suggest the idea that individual human beings are the only source of direct moral value from there. If you look at something like our Constitution, I think this idea that all human beings, that all people are endowed with inalienable individual rights. I mean, part of what makes us uncomfortable about this idea that I would steer the bus into a truck to take another life is ultimately I'm violating the individual rights of that human being, right? From there? So that this idea that focuses on individual human beings, animal welfare we're talking about before, all living beings deserve equal respect and consideration of their interests. Now that's all living beings. Some folks would say only those that can experience pleasure and pain. Some folks would say only those that actually have a broader sense of their own lives from there. Although Leopold, ecocentrism, focusing on the whole, a holistic perspective that looks at the biotic community. Leopold, or an ecocentrist, never says that an individual deer has human rights. For that matter, does an individual human have human rights? Is it the case that our perspective is ultimately limited by being too individualistic? And finally, this notion of Christian stewardship, which we'll talk a lot more about, that humans were created in God's image and given the responsibility to care for the rest of creation. This is an anthropocentric, a human-centered focus that ultimately puts humans in the driver's seat, but says our responsibility is to care for the rest of creation along the way. Leopold and the animal welfare folks want to see human beings more as ecological citizens with a sense of equality with other parts of creation the fundamental of idea of stewardship still preserves a separation between humans and creation, but wants to base that on the notion that humans have an extra responsibility. We're the gardeners that have to care for the garden. We are not, in any sense, equal with the rest of creation.
There was Phil Hefner, who was systematic theologian at Chicago Seminary. I think coined the word that we have now, with the abilities we have, become co-creators with God of the future.
And that, I mean, I think is a nice way of putting it, that sort of, that preserves one of the things that lots of folks in environmental ethics want to point at, which is a separation between humans and the rest of creation. But this elevates humans as co-creators of what's going on from there. Is that perspective the one that is most useful for us as we think about things going forward? Is that the right perspective that sort of separates us out from there? Again, I didn't come here to provide answers. I came to ask the questions in thinking about how we do it from there. And I want to be sensitive to time. We're 5 minutes after from there. I'd be happy to stay and answer questions or talk with others, but I also want to recognize that others have other things to do along the way from there. So feel free to leave.